Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and today I welcome you, especially those of you who tuned in. It's my 50th show, and what a sweet show it is, or will be. We're talking about chocolate. And today's show is sponsored by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures, all natural grass-fed beef, has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. We hope that you'll support their program through your purchase of our beef through one of these Whole Foods stores. For more information, go to www.whiteoakpastures.com. And as I mentioned, it's a sweet show, my 50th show, and I figured it's also just about Valentine's Day, and our thoughts start to turn to gifts for people we love, and chocolate bounces out, right, in my mind. That's the one thing that everyone loves, and I think it has been called the food of the gods and a divine obsession. And indeed, chocolate is, it just brings something about in certain people. And they say women, during different hormonal shifts, have a craving for chocolate. There's something in chocolate that they love. Other people have called it an aphrodisiac. We're going to find out about that from my guest, Alexandra Leaf. We want to know where the idea of giving chocolates for Valentine's Day came from, too, because that just didn't happen automatically. Somebody had to start that one. It's, you know, for chocolate being one of the most popular foods in the world, it really has a rather elusive history. We all enjoy it, but most of us don't know where it comes from, how it started. Hopefully, Alexandra will be able to fill us in on that. Alexandra is a culinary historian and an award-winning cookbook author. She's been involved with the Chocolate Show, New York City's annual chocolate extravaganza, since its founding in 1997. As a chocolate educator, she travels the country lecturing on the history, the manufacture, and appreciation of fine chocolate. And Alexandra gives chocolate tours, and you can find out about her tours at chocolatetoursnyc.com. She also leads tasting classes at the Institute of Culinary Education and the 92nd Street Y. And she's a frequent contributor to different newspapers and magazines like Gastronomica and Country Living. And a good friend. It's nice to have a good friend who knows about chocolate. Welcome, Alexandra.
Thanks, Linda.
So tell me, do you know where the idea of giving chocolate for Valentine's Day came from?
Well, I always think of chocolate as the best-known food that nobody knows anything about.
And
your comment that chocolate is elusive, or at least the history of chocolate is elusive, and that's true of so much food and so many food ways. It's often something that's just such an intrinsic part of culture. People fail to really ask the deep questions or actually do the homework to figure things out. My birthday is Valentine's Day. I don't know whether you know that.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is very funny, and I didn't
Well, this is even more of a coincidence. Well, then, wonderful.
Yeah,
okay.
And I have to say that I didn't like chocolate until I was in my 20s. So I understand my son when he says, oh, I don't like chocolate. My daughter loves chocolate. But I tend to think that the idea of giving chocolate on Valentine's Day comes somehow from this lingering notion that chocolate or cacao, that sort of more raw form of chocolate, was an aphrodisiac. The book that I love best because I think she's really done her homework, is The True History of Chocolate by Sophie Coe.
Mm-hmm.
And very early on, practically the first chapter, she just, you know, dismisses this idea that chocolate is an aphrodisiac.
Oh, darn.
The foods that were unknown to the Europeans, in other words, the foods that came from the New World, from our part of the world here, and went back to Europe with, you know, during the Age of Exploration, these were foods, of course, that the Europeans there had never seen before. Potatoes, corn, tomatoes. And so foods that were unknown tended to be viewed with great skepticism and often were just sort of thrown into this pile of, an aphrodisiac. And, you know, perhaps because of the stimulating aspects, there is theobromine in it. Mm-hmm. That's the compound which, of course, is lethal to dogs. So everybody, if you are going to have chocolate around, be careful. Dogs will jump up on counters, grab chocolate, and get very sick from it. So watch out. So that compound theobromine is very much like a caffeine. You know, it's a stimulant. So
well, and perhaps, that actually translates into food of the gods, theobromine.
Yeah, that's right. Dieu, Théo, Dieu, Ti, you know, mm-hmm. Théo, Dio. Yeah, exactly, the Latin roots. So I think that that's perhaps where the original sort of related to love or, you know, erotic in some way. The other thing is it could be the iconography. I mean, you have these incredible paintings, French and Italian paintings of, you know, breakfast in the boudoir, and these people are, you know, in states of semi-dress, being served their chocolate.
Sipping their chocolate, right.
That's right. Sipping chocolate.
Well,
in
now
bed,
that, and I, what I failed to mention is your books, you have two beautiful books, and you relate the food world and the art world in your books. You have Van Gogh's Table and The Impressionist Table, both books that relate food and art. But the sipping of the chocolate. So basically, we should I guess back up and talk about a timeline really where a lot of people attribute the first chocolate or the production of chocolate to the Mayans, but is that, I don't know if that's necessarily...
Yeah. I mean, chocolate consumption, you know, we can say is about 3,000 years old. The native form was a heavily spiced, water-based beverage. Now, for us, you know, we've grown up in this more European tradition, and it's always, you know, hot chocolate with some form of, you know, dairy. It's cream or half and half, milk, something like that. But, of course, there were no cows in this part of the world until the Spaniards brought them. So these were water-based drinks, and people basically crushed up whatever they had on hand, which was vanilla. There were chilies. So this chili spiked stuff that people like today, it's mm-hmm. really as old as time. It's not a new
Nothing
form
new,
of
right.
chocolate. Yeah. And so it was frothed, you know, it was beaten up with, let's say, a whisk kind of instrument. That's the way the Spaniards had it. But the original form was just this water-based drink of crushed stuff, which when you look at the accounts of the Spaniards writing about this, it's like, you know, food for pigs, disgusting stuff. You know, and of course the Spaniards with their, you know, big beards and mustaches, you know, men then had a lot of facial hair, and certainly after the voyage, you know, hadn't been shaving. So they would get the achiote, this orange mm-hmm. kind of, you know, these ingredients that were all mixed up, and it would be on their, you know, beard and stuff. They and mustache must have not looked very attractive.
But when did it come that we added the sweetening to it, the sugar, and made it a palatable drink to European taste or Western culture tastes?
Well, when chocolate was embraced by the Europeans and really in the 1700s, it starts to become very popular. Although, you know, in the 1600s is when the beans start coming over with other products that are being brought. But it didn't really take off. Of course, you know, what Europeans were drinking then, tea was well known and understood. And people did sweeten it with sugar or honey. Of course, sugar then was viewed in a medicinal way. Was very expensive,
mm-hmm.
And coffee also would be sweetened. So you had a bitter tasting drink that could sort of be brought into this drink lexicon, if you will. So for the Europeans, that was not too difficult to understand how to use it, because the beans were roasted in the same way that coffee beans are roasted. So there was something similar enough for Europeans too. And if I can just make a comment also that, in Spain, and which was largely Catholic at the time, because cacao was drunk and not eaten, mm-hmm. that it was not considered, you didn't break the fast if you were drinking chocolate. So it really took off in Spain. Yes, and then later in Italy and France.
And then the Dutch got a hold of it.
Right? Yes, 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 and the famous Dutching process.
Which is making the cocoa from it, deriving the cocoa from the bean. Well, first of all, a lot of people don't know how cocoa is, how cacao, how chocolate is gotten. So talk a little about that. I mean, I did post a picture. Hopefully people will be able to see it on the website today. Of these beautiful, huge pods growing on trees. Where does the majority of cocoa grow?
Yeah, well, they're absolutely fantastic looking. I was so excited after looking at images for a very long time of these pods to actually walk among cacao trees and see them there.
Where? Well, where
cacao,
did you walk?
Yeah, cacao is an equatorial plant that thrives 20 degrees approximately north and south of the equator. So it's really a band around the world. And we're starting to see more and more cacao being planted in areas where there has not been a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Because, there is a great demand. People are concerned about a possible shortage in the future of cacao. But I happened to be in Belize. I was invited by the company Green and Blacks to go look at a cacao collective there in Punta Gorda. And so the cacao tree is basically producing these pods on a year-round basis. But there are two principal crops, roughly 6 months apart. Because, of course, we have to think of this as a business. And you're not going to, and hopefully you're in pursuit of ripe pods. I mean, the really, really large industrial companies just go out there and they hack down all the pods, whether they're ripe or not.
Mm-hmm.
And, as you know, a fruit tastes better, and cacao really is a fruit, tastes better when it's allowed to fully ripen. So in an ideal world, your pod is ripe. And there's a tremendous diversity of color in cacao pods, from a yellow to a pale orange to a deep, deep orange to even almost a burgundy, deep burgundy, mm-hmm. with like a lot of red notes
deep red,
in it.
Right.
Yes, and according to the varietal, the color will be different. Or some of the pods are really deeply crenellated. So you've got these like long ridges down the sides. Some are smooth. There are three principal types, and then lots of kind of like sub varietals. And people may be aware that Mars and Hershey's have been doing a tremendous amount of experimentation now, because what everyone is looking for in a cacao tree is disease resistance, being a big producer, and being a flavorful varietal. And at first, what the large companies were doing was experimenting with genetics only to get something that was very disease resistant. But then you had flavor that was completely mediocre. Then they would have to roast the heck out of the beans to get any flavor, and then add a lot of vanilla to give it flavor. Now, what they're really looking at is, as I said before, something that's a wonderful balance, where you are getting good flavor and you're getting disease resistance.
But that's a question I have too, is are all the beans, all right, the beans are in the pod and then they're roasted, are they all, and then they all go through a fermentation process?
Well, what first happens is the pods, hopefully they're ripe, are harvested. Okay, then they're opened carefully, because when you open them with a machete, you don't want to cut into the bean because you're injuring it.
Right.
So the beans are removed. They're covered with this white mucilaginous substance, which actually vinegar can be made from. There are beers that are made from that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the beans are then collected up, and again, in an ideal situation, they're put into large wooden fermentation boxes. And the fermentation can go on for, 3 days, 4 days, five, up to about a week, depending on the amount of beans. Some varietals will ferment faster. So that fermentation is really the beginning of the development of flavor. You know, if you were to just take one of those beans out and suck on it, well, it'll be delicious in that kind of like lychee sense, because what you're tasting is the white on the outside. If mm-hmm. you were to bite into the bean, first of all, you wouldn't taste chocolate at all, and you would taste something that's very bitter because the alkaloid content is very high right. at that point. Yeah. So basically, during all these processes, so we've had the fermentation process, and then the beans need to be dried, and they need to be dried really well. So they're left out. It can be in a very primitive form, drying on plastic tarp on someone's little terrace. Or it can be done on patios and sometimes on raised, very often on raised surfaces. In an area where those drying racks can be pushed underneath, some sheltered area, because you're contending with maybe a rainy season. So you want maximum amount of drying, and you also don't want the beans baking in the sun when the sun is very, very harsh, because mm-hmm. you want it. It's like anything. You just have to do things slowly and carefully.
Then, well, we'll get to talking about the grinding and the cocoa butter and the types of chocolates, which, and then of course, the edible kind that we can chew into. But first, we're going to take a short break, and I want to leave people with a question. You talked about Hershey's and Mars experimenting with a lot of types of chocolate, and Hershey's. Well, should, because they produce so much chocolate. A little question, a little quiz question before we go to a break, and I'll let people think about it, and that's, how many Hershey's Kisses are manufactured on an average day at the Hershey Chocolate Factory? And then we'll take a little break and come back and give you the answer, so stay tuned.
Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love. Wait a minute, something going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, talking about how she can make it right. Yeah, happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. Nothing wrong being in love with someone, yeah. Oh, baby, love and happiness.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, and we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I left you with a question. How many Hershey's Kisses are manufactured on an average day at the Hershey's factory? Is it 10 million? Is it 50 million? Believe it or not, it's 80 million. 80 million Hershey's Kisses on an average day. That's a lot of chocolate. That's a lot of Hershey Kisses. All right, now, and the quality is different in chocolates, we know. And so finally, we've got these beans, and we grind them up in these big machines. And how do we get to the chocolate bar?
Well, the really fine, most expensive, best chocolate, and best, it's very subjective, but best means a chocolate whose ingredients start with cocoa beans, not sugar. Mm. Cocoa beans, some form of cocoa beans, chocolate liquor means ground beans, sugar. You do want additional cocoa butter. It just makes a richer bar. And the whole artisan movement here in this country is actually shying away from adding vanilla.
Hmm. Not flavor. They don't want to artificially flavor the actual chocolate.
Yep. Some are doing it. Some aren't. Actually, some are trying to really take a very minimal approach and aren't even adding additional cocoa butter. But you do get a more luxurious mouthfeel.
And the cocoa butter being, that's the, what is the, explain what the cocoa butter is.
Yeah, cocoa butter is basically a byproduct of the manufacturing, of the processing of chocolate, of cocoa beans. So in other words, I mean, depends what you're going to do with them. If you're one of these bean-to-bar artisan makers, you're just going to grind and grind and grind until you get something that's very, very smooth. Conching is the process.
Right.
And you're going to stop there. But if you're a very large company that's interested in selling cocoa butter to the cosmetics industry, which pays a premium for it, you're going to have to process that bean all the way through. So essentially, you're separating the liquid, the fat, from the solid, and then you're left with cocoa powder.
Mm-hmm.
So cocoa powder is not part of chocolate making. If you're making chocolate for eating bars,
right.
It's if you are processing it for the purpose of obtaining cocoa butter. So you could sell that cocoa butter to a chocolate company that needs that extra cocoa butter because it's making this very luxurious, rich, or then you sell it elsewhere.
And it's so amazing because you can, when you see the beans, when they're first dried, do you sense, like with coffee beans, do you sense any oiliness in them?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. They're very, very hard, actually. After the drying, there's a slight cocoa dimension to them. Roast them, then you're getting some more. But every step along the way is bringing out a more, let's say, the other profiles.
The essence, the chocolate essence,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
yeah.
Today on today's market, we see, and we'll talk about that, the artisanal, we're back to, the finer chocolate making and artisanal movements. And I know a lot of people are confused. They look at chocolate on the shelves and they see 70%, 60%, and then they taste it and their taste buds are often surprised. They think, oh, I'm going to get a very chocolatey, fine chocolate. I'll buy the 70% bar. Mm. Talk about what the percentages are, what the percentages mean and how that dictates flavor.
Yeah, I agree. It can be overwhelming, even for someone like myself who really knows the chocolate world. If I'm in Whole Foods and I walk by and I periodically check, it's like, whoa, if I had to buy a bar of chocolate quickly, like any other shopper, and you're in, trying to get in and out, look and you say, oh my gosh, where do I even start? And what the percentage basically means is what is contained in that bar that is made exclusively from the bean. So in other words, a 70% bar, 70% of what's in that bar comes from the cocoa bean. The remaining 30% is sugar, lecithin, vanilla. I mean, vanilla is, 1% or something, 2%. It's very, very small. But that's really what it is. As we hear that dark chocolate is good for us and, the darker the better, we're now seeing 100%, 99%. I think even Lindt is doing a 90, or maybe it's only available in Europe. But we're seeing these ever higher percentages. What I'm actually very interested in, I'm not a big milk chocolate fan, although some milk chocolate is really good. The term dark milk is not a contradiction in terms.
It sounds oxymoronic.
It's actually a dark chocolate that has milk solids in it. So you could have a 60% dark, and then you add some milk powder, and then so you're going to get a richer, a deeper tasting.
Well,
milk
more
chocolate.
Palatable, because if anyone's bitten into a 70%. Chocolate bar, 70% cocoa bean chocolate bar, you find it's almost dry, and it's not as smooth a texture for a lot of people who aren't used to tasting chocolates. It'll be like a bitter dryness.
See, that really depends on the manufacturing. The French, they're very famous for fat cheeses, butters. Their approach, and you really do see these national differences. There's definitely an Italian style of chocolate making. There's a Swiss style. There is a French style. The French add lots of extra cocoa butter, the artisanal, the more industrialized ones are, you know.
So you get that smoothness and that meltability.
Incredibly, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, a company like Praluz, P-R-A-L-U-S, that I really love, their 70% contains more cocoa butter than any other company. But you wouldn't know that because since cocoa butter is part of a cocoa bean, the 70% does not reflect the additional cocoa butter.
Interesting.
Right, because it's a product of the cocoa bean. Uh-huh. Right, so you wouldn't know that unless you buy it or you read about it or you're listening to this show. And
so it's really about the quality of the producer, whether
and
you get
the style of the producer, yes,
flavor.
And the quality of the beans. There's so many variables, and that's you can definitely talk about terroir and chocolate. You will get different flavor profiles.
Well, I was reading that the majority of the chocolate really is grown in West Africa, is that?
Yeah, in the
Africa?
Ivory Coast. The Ivory mm-hmm. Coast, actually, is such a big producer that the five next countries put together don't even total.
Don't even touch where they're
Ivory
where they
Coast's
are.
Production. That's right. Yeah. Ghana is another really big producer. That whole part of West Africa.
Interesting. But the largest manufacturers, I mean, is just about every country is manufacturing chocolate in their own, as you mentioned, in their own style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big business. There's a lot of competition to supply that to people.
Yeah, and what's really exciting, there are more little guys who we don't even know about yet. I get together with some people. We call ourselves the Manhattan Chocolate Society, and we taste chocolate together, like a wine appreciation, but we're doing it with chocolate. And our members travel, and like one was at the San Francisco Fancy Food Show and talked to some small producers. So we will taste the chocolate, and then we'll give our feedback. And these are people we haven't even heard of. They're not even ready to be selling their chocolates too publicly yet. They're there just to make contacts, and so like out of their garage, because you can Chocolate Alchemy is a website, where you can get
Chocolate Alchemy. Interesting.
Yeah, you can buy beans in a small quantity. You can get everything you need to make your own chocolate.
Like home brewing, you can home
totally,
chocolate
making,
right?
Totally, that's right. Yep, absolutely.
Well, you mentioned wine, and wines and chocolate. People talk about chocolate notes in a wine, but there mm-hmm. are also certain wines that are best paired with chocolate, too.
Yep.
I mean, it's become this, this big gastronomic industry, pairing different foods together. But champagne, you mentioned, is something that goes quite well with chocolate.
Well, the rule of thumb is that what you're drinking should be sweeter than your chocolate.
Oh.
And there are tannins in cocoa beans and, of course, tannins in especially red wine.
Yeah.
So what I really like is to just look to the fortified dessert wine category. And I love Quadi. Andrew Quadi is a producer in Napa. And he loves chocolate. And almost all of his wines, whether it's a port style or it's an orange muscat, they're beautiful. I think that you have a better success because, the classic port, ruby port, as opposed mm-hmm. to a tawny or something. I mean, a tawny might be okay. But you have better luck if what you're drinking is going to be a little bit sweeter.
Interesting. I would not have gone to the sweeter drinks with chocolate. I would have let the chocolate come through.
Yeah. Well, it's all what you like in the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to think that when Christopher Columbus first brought back cocoa beans, they basically disregarded them.
That's right.
Tossed them aside, right? Well, nobody knew what to do with them. They didn't know how to grind them.
Yeah.
Very interesting. That it took a few people and few initiatives to bring it to bear. The other interesting thing that I think was that almonds are a big match with chocolate. I'm not sure how that came to be, because almonds themselves have a lot of oil in them as well.
Yeah. In fact, one of the reasons that the United States is that our USDA is interested in what's going on with cacao in the world is because we have a huge amount of almonds that we need to sell to confectionery. I mean, a huge amount of our almonds leave the United States to go abroad to be in candy bars. I don't really know how all of that started, but I mean, if you think of
finding another use for the almond.
Of Gianduja. Yeah, yeah,
well, that's
maybe.
Right. Yeah, Gianduja, very.
Yeah, I mean, and when we think about Nutella, the mm-hmm. reason that, I mean, Nutella was born during the war when chocolate was scarce. So the hazelnut.
Hazelnut was primarily.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah, the
and so, you know, you grind those down again, the fat. And mm-hmm. so that's kind of how that happened. And so maybe there was just this notion of, nuts. Because certainly nuts were not being ground up to be a part of. But
well, it's a great combination. Whoever decided to do it was wonderful. And then somebody had credited Cadbury with promoting the chocolate for Valentine's Day. But you were mentioning earlier before the show that it probably all started with the box. Right?
Yeah, yeah, which was the Belgians who came up with the idea of selling chocolate. Selling bonbons, you know, candies, because that's very different from a bar experience of chocolate. Because once you had the industrialization of chocolate, you had, you know, chocolate being made by machinery, mm-hmm. as opposed to the hand grinding and that kind of thing. But then this notion of selling the little individual bonbons in a box, and then giving that's a present of food.
Well, it was a wonderful
late 19th century.
Yeah, yeah. I would think middle to late 19th century, mm-hmm. and it persists today. It's a big business. I think the chocolate sellers probably do more business in that, you know, week's time than they do for many of the months. Well, certainly summer months.
Yeah, and it's funny because Jacques Torres likes to talk about the difference in buying habits between men and women, and he'll have, women that are, you know, a week to 10 days before Valentine's Day are very thoughtfully selecting the chocolates for their husbands. And then on the day of Valentine's Day, especially as it gets later and later, these guys just rush in and like throw $50 at the cashier. They just want to get in and out very quickly. And then in Japan, something that's very interesting is that on Valentine's Day, women buy chocolate for men. And it could be a woman buying chocolate for her boss. Or a Japanese friend was saying that a woman might give chocolate to a prospective, sort of a love interest.
But so it's there. It's the whole Valentine's theme is there. Well, whomever you are buying your chocolates for, I hope that you have a wonderful Valentine's Day. And I thank our listeners for listening in today and in celebrating my 50th show with me. And I think I'm going to treat myself to some chocolates later today. You've gotten it going. I'm Linda Palaccio. Thank you so much for joining me and my guest, Alexandra Leaf, on A Taste of the Past. And thank you to my producer, Jack Inslee.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.